Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Okay, quick thought exercise. Of all the challenges to a marriage, what is the worst thing your partner could do? Is there anything you couldn't forgive? Any act that would require you to call it quits? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Many of us would reflexively point to infidelity as a deal breaker, especially if it was our partner who did the cheating. It's a little hard to pin down exactly how common it is for people to have sex with somebody other than their spouse during the course of a marriage. It's not easy to admit to a researcher that you've cheated or been cheated on. But researchers at UT have estimated that an affair will take place within 40 to 76% of all marriages, which would suggest some relationships can and do survive an act of infidelity, and some people who cheat have no desire to leave their spouse. Esther Perel is a relationship therapist and TED speaker who says we might all benefit from looking at cheating through a different lens. She'll be in town Friday to conduct a workshop called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity at SMU Plano. Esther, welcome to Think.
Pleasure. Thank you.
The shock of discovering a partner has cheated is probably especially strong for people who thought they were in a happy marriage. In your experience as a therapist, though, you've actually met a number of legitimately happily married people who cheat. So what is cheating about if it's not always a response to dissatisfaction with one's spouse?
So once you've called it cheating, you immediately organize the experience by virtue of its dishonesty, by the betrayal, by the lying, by the deception. And while these are essential ingredients of any infidelity, at the heart of an affair, you will often find betrayal, but you will also find longing and loss, a yearning to reconnect with lost parts of ourselves, a wish to beat back deadness, a wish to react to years of sexual frustration, a quest for aliveness, for sexual adventure, for emotional intimacy, for intensity, lots of things that people may yearn for. And sometimes they even have those in their relationship, but they are looking for more or looking for something else or looking for the relationship that they didn't have. Or I often like to say that sometimes, especially when we ask why do happy people cheat, it isn't always because they want to leave their partner as much as they want to leave the person that they have themselves become. And it's not so much that they're looking for another partner as much as they're trying to look for another self. So it's much more, in those cases, an experience of a quest for one's own growth and self-discovery and self-actualization than it is a rejection of the person that one is with.
So to an extent that some affairs are, an effort, whether consciously or not, to reconnect with lost parts of ourselves or regain our diminished sense of self, I mean, does it work? Is it an effective strategy to make one feel more alive and connected?
So, you know, typically we like to think that an affair is a symptom of a relationship gone awry. Meaning if you have everything at home, there would be no reason to go looking elsewhere. Hence, if you're going looking elsewhere, there must be something missing and something wrong. And either there's something wrong in your relationship or there's something wrong in you. That's the deficiency model of infidelity, and it is one that, of course, represents a lot of affairs, but it is only one angle into this vast, expansive experience. If you're talking about 40 to 76%, then you understand that there isn't one kind of infidelity, one kind of affair, and certainly not one kind of marriage to whom it happens. The word that people in more than 20 countries tell me everywhere I go when I ask them about their affairs is that they feel alive. They don't talk about sex. They don't talk about many other things. They talk about desire. They talk about self-affirmation. They talk about feeling that they matter, that they are important, that they are special. They feel focused, present. They feel alive. They feel often what they felt in the early stages of their relationship. which for sometimes from their own doing they have lost. This is not because they don't have it and hence they blame their partner. That's not the point. The point is sometimes people don't know how to cultivate that kind of intensity in the context of marriage, of family life, of responsibilities to extended family, of dealing with the economic hardships. I mean, there is an entire reality that one lives in, that when you are in the secret, elusive space of an affair, you are completely shielded from. So it is a utopian environment after all.
Right, because you're having an affair, you don't have to, like, you know, choose a new refrigerator with that person. You don't have to figure out who's going to do the chores. Is that it, that there's only the good parts, the fun parts of a relationship in an affair and not the other things that come along with a life partnership?
I don't know that I would say it like that, because affairs are sometimes very painful, because people wonder, what is the right that I have to pursue my own happiness if it's going to hurt people that I love dearly, my partner, my spouse, my children, my friends even, because sometimes one wonders, you know, I love this person, but I don't think I could actually make a life with this person. We live in completely different parts of the world. We come from completely different backgrounds. We can't uproot each other from our own respective families. It isn't just joy and fun. People have this notion that affairs are, you know, I'm talking about affairs. I'm not talking about any other, you know, other recreational forms of extra relational sex here. We're talking about stories, and these stories have their ups and downs. The fear of losing each other, but also the fear of losing the lives that people have worked very hard to build. So it's not, you know, family is drudge and affairs is fun and light. It's that it's very separate realities. One reality is a reality that is public. The other is private. One is acknowledged by the world outside. The other is hidden. One has history. The other is often rather new. One has a family. The other may never have a family. I mean, they are separate realities. I don't know that you want to make one the light and one the dark, or one the happy one and one the sad one. On occasion, that is the case. People do often seek something outside of their relationship because they're miserable at home, because they're lonely at home, because they feel unattended at home, because they feel they've become a function and just a role, and they have lost their essence. But if we're asking about the broader range of even why do the people who are happy to come home, who would never want to end their relationship, who love their family, this is something else. For many people, this is the one thing that is theirs as well. This is not a, you know, in an affair, you are not responsible for anybody. In an affair, you really are doing something that is for you and for you only. And for some people, that is strongly missing in the context of their family lives. They feel like they're given to everybody, men and women. They feel like they're there for everyone. Everyone counts on them. Everyone reposes on them. They have to take care. They are accountable. And this place is a place that just doesn't ask any of that for them. It's a place of pure feeling. It has nothing else to accomplish sometimes. Now, there is again a difference if people wonder if they want to leave their relationships in order to pursue their new love relation. That's a different story. But in the event that the affair is meant to be just that, an affair, it isn't meant to become another marriage, people who are very happy to go home, it's a different part of them. It's a different set of relationships. But there is something about the affair that is utopian in the sense that it only exists for its actual riches. It has no other raison d'être than the quality of the connection that exists between the two people.
There are people who will say when you sign up for marriage, you sign up for a certain amount of compromise and even sacrifice. What do you say to people who believe that a partner who feels uninspired within the marriage should just learn to suck it up because they promised lifelong fidelity?
That's right. But sometimes their partner also promised them that they would pay attention to them, that they would be respectful, that they won't be contemptuous, that they won't be indifferent, that they won't ignore them, that they won't drink on them the whole night, that they won't beat them, that they won't betray them in multiple other ways, even though they are being faithful. So betrayal comes in many forms, and sexual betrayal is only one kind of betrayal in a relationship. Every relationship demands compromise and sacrifice, but when one person seeks a kind of moral superiority on the other person. It's not just that people are not inspired. That is making it also more simple. What if, I get a letter yesterday from a woman, we are married 10 years, 7 without any sex, any connection, barely any touch. We go to bed like roommates. We have a wonderful relationship. I am 41 years old. I'm about to pass the years of having children because I can't even make a child with this man in terms of making love to him so that we would have a child. Of course, I can go to a sperm bank. Yeah, I am lonely. I miss him. And what am I to do? These are the kinds of letters I also receive from men and women in straight couples and in heterosexual couples and in same-sex couples. So it's not just some simple, I'm going to go and have fun. Those exist, but that's not, it's not the people that I necessarily have been studying. I've always wondered, to take that risk, to be willing to lose everything one has built, to be at risk of losing one's children, to be at risk of being put to death, which in many countries is still, 9 countries are still killing women for that. One must have a real powerful reason. It isn't just something that one does easily. Why are people willing to risk everything for a glimmer of what? So when people may cross that line, and the vast majority of people who have affairs have been faithful for decades, they are not recidivists, they are not compulsive cheaters, they are people who have been faithful, sexually exclusive and monogamous, sometimes for decades. So when one day they cross a line, it's actually important to find out why. Why now? What made this finally happen for them? And I think that it's in understanding those motives that also lies the recovery and the possibility for a relationship to reclaim itself and to continue. If it just becomes a blame of what you've done to me and how you broke our vows and how, now, sometimes the partner who was betrayed will say, you think I didn't want to? You think I haven't missed certain things? But I didn't do it. You're the one who crossed that line. And they're right.
Esther, let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break, and I want to make sure that you have time to finish this thought. So we're going to pause it here, and we'll come back to this in just a minute. We are speaking this hour with relationship therapist and TED speaker Esther Perel. She'll be in town Friday to conduct a workshop called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity at SMU Plano. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Margie Evans, nationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with relationship therapist and TED speaker Esther Perel. She'll be in town Friday to conduct a workshop called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity at SMU Plano. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or you can email think@kera.org. Before the break, Esther, you were saying sometimes, an affair has happened and the partner who did not commit infidelity says, wait a second, you think I didn't long for those things, but I didn't break the vows of our relationship?
Yes, because I held myself to our agreement and you broke our agreement. I mean, an affair is primarily a violation of trust. It is a breach of a contract. And when you read the title of the conference, Rethinking Infidelity, I think it's important to say this is such a gut-wrenching, painful experience. And it's very black and white. It's a very polarized subject. For many, many years, people did not talk about divorce. That was where the stigma was. Today, divorce is pretty much a public subject, but infidelity is the new stigma. And staying, if your partner has cheated on you, especially if you can leave, is the new shame. So it's important to say that in trying to embrace the complexity of this major event in many, many marriages, and infidelity has existed since marriage was invented, So it's important to know that it's not because one doesn't launch into a flat-out condemnation, that doesn't mean that one is condoning. Understanding doesn't mean justifying. But I do look at it from a dual perspective. It is hurt and betrayal for one, and often growth and expansion for the other. And it is the ability to hold this real contradiction that actually will help couples recover from an affair and often renew their vows, and often even for a relationship that may be better than the one that they had come to.
All right, I want to talk about disclosure. If those UT figures that I mentioned at the top of somewhere between 4 and 7 in 10 marriages are compromised at some point by an affair, that would suggest there are a lot of people out there who have committed infidelity and gotten away with it if their partner is unaware and the person who has had the affair wishes to stay married. Does it make sense to come clean?
Well, I think that one of the things that is important to highlight is the difficulty of the statistics. Yeah, most of it is, have you had sex with a partner other than your own in the last 12 months? Well, what do we mean by sex? Are we going by the Clintonian definition? Are we going by the millennial definition? You know, the interesting thing about infidelity is that the definition keeps on expanding. Chat rooms, massages with happy endings, staying on your dating apps when you're already in a steady relationship, pornography. There is more and more experiences that have been defined, at least often by the person to whom it is done too, as a betrayal, as a deception, as a going outside of our contract. The question of disclosure is a very interesting and very culturally laden question, because the United States is a culture that is more egalitarian than others, still has a lot of work to do. But within an egalitarian framework, we value transparency. We believe in the moral cure of honesty, and we define honesty as a kind of a confession that will then lead to an atonement, that will then lead to a kind of absolution and hopefully a forgiveness. In many countries in the world, honesty is not about you're telling the other person, and there's not necessarily a virtue in telling. It's in your thinking, how will what you have to say, how is that going to affect the other person? And so if it's going to just hurt them unnecessarily, why tell it to them? What is the point? And so I think that the question of disclosure is a very sensitive one, and one that needs to often be examined with the benefits and the costs to the person to whom it is being told to. There are places where lying is always wrong. It is an absolute moral infringement. And there are places and cultures in the world where, by definition, lying is often seen as protective. When you are on one side, you can't conceive the other. This is how divisive these kinds of truths often become. And as a cross-cultural psychologist, I try to hold these many different definitions so that when I work with couples, I have a sense of what is the space in which they live, what are their belief systems. How do we define courage? Is courage defined by deal with your own messes, you did it, take responsibility, handle it, finish it, come back home and continue doing what you're supposed to do? Or is courage, you did it, you must come clean, you should disclose because that's where your strength lies, rather than walking around with a lie. And that lie, by definition, will eat away at your intimacy and you will never be able to be as close again. And maybe rather than looking at these as kind of scientific truths, I would invite us to look at these as belief systems and as narratives for our lives that often then will dictate how we will act. But people need to examine it on both sides. The advantage of revelation and the cost of revelation, and the advantage of secrecy and the cost of secrecy.
So I understand completely the point you made earlier, which is that a person who engages in infidelity, it's not necessarily all fun for them. It can be emotionally wrenching in some complex ways. On the other hand, this is a choice that they have made. The partner who is, and I know you don't like this word, but the partner who is cheated on, there's really no other way to feel except betrayed and hurt and devastated. So what do you suggest that the partner whose partner has committed infidelity do with this information if it is, you know, if they do become aware of it, and how can they rebuild when they feel that they have been wronged?
So I think that it is often a story in stages. Yes, you feel betrayed. Of course you do. You feel jealous. Your partner took their love and their desires to someone else. You have desires for vengeance sometimes. These are not always noble feelings. You want to expose your partner. Sometimes you feel like you're caught in a toxic secret because now you have to be silent about the affair which you know about because you want to protect your partner to the rest of the community because you don't want everybody else to judge them or you for staying with that person and for still loving that person. It's intense. In the beginning stage, you go back and forth with a succession of contradictory emotions. 1 minute is I love you. 1 minute is I hate you. 1 minute is hold me. 1 minute is not, don't touch me. 1 minute is make love to me. 1 minute is get out of here. It's really a real intense maelstrom. And the most important thing on the part of the person who was involved is to be able to show guilt and remorse for hurting their partner. You may not always feel guilty for the affair itself, but you are generally, if you care about your partner, you feel terrible for how bad it they feel, for how gut-wrenching it is for them. And that is the first thing, is not a, yes, I feel bad for you, but it's I am accountable for what I did, and I know that what I did is devastating to you. I lied to you, I deceived you, I gaslighted you, whatever the tactics that people use, it's not pretty. And then the second thing on the part of the person who was involved is to also become the person who holds the relationship for a while. This is all in the initial days, weeks, hours, months, you know. You hold the relationship, meaning you don't wait for the person to bring up questions, to want to figure it out, to understand. Is the, when you said you were there, were you really there? You know, is my whole life just kind of a complete, you know, miss? And did I mistake and everything and I have to rewrite the whole history? You actually go to them and you say, are you okay? How are you thinking about this? Is there anything you want to talk about? Because if you bring it up, then your partner isn't caught in the obsessiveness about it. And if you are not trying to avoid it because, you know, when your nightmare stops, the other person's nightmare begins and they want to know and you kind of wish that they would stop asking, that deluge of questions is totally normal. And then the third thing is to, so you become a kind of the vigilant of the relationship. And you do things that give back the other person a sense that they matter. Because if you've gone elsewhere and all that time you were not interested in me or you were involved, you know, in giving to someone else, I need to know that you still care about me, that I matter, that I'm special. And anything you can do to elevate, to reevaluate, to validate that person is really, really essential. And on the part of the person who was hurt and betrayed, I think the very important thing straight from the beginning is to understand the difference between questions that are detective questions, I call them, and that plunge you into the sordid details and keep you awake every night. And you want to know the stuff that ultimately will hurt you but won't help you understand why this happened and the way it happened, versus investigative questions. We'd really mind the meanings and the motives. You know, what happened to you? Why did this happen now? Were you thinking of me? Did you want me to find out? Did you hope that it would end? Did you hope that it would continue? Did you think about our children? Did you think about the way that your father did this to your mother and that you promised yourself you would never be like this person and here you are doing the same thing, you know, and that those kinds of questions really give power because they give the possibility for the person who was betrayed to then make choices. And then from the first crisis stage, we move to the meaning-making stage. And from the meaning-making stage, we move to the, if we want to stay together, what kind of relationship will we be? What's the new vision for our relationship? How do we continue from here? Or if we are to decide that we will separate, we may separate, but it's not just because of this one event. We will separate because this one event came to highlight a slew of other issues that we were oblivious or denying, or because there is a breach that I just cannot come from, or because I fell in love with someone else and I realized that I have not been the right partner to you and I need to move on. So there are three stages. They're not always neatly aligned in a linear fashion. Things come up, but the essence of it is really to be responsible on the part of the person who hurt and to be accountable and to show that you didn't do this just out of malicious vengeance, which sometimes is the case, but then the relationship was probably already in trouble long before.
My guest is relationship therapist Esther Perel. She is in town Friday, or will be in town Friday, to conduct a workshop called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. That'll happen at SMU Plano. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org. You can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 800-933-5372. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with relationship therapist Esther Perel. She's done a couple of TED Talks that you can find online, and she'll be in town Friday to conduct a workshop called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity, that happens at SMU in Plano. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Esther, how are marriages that do survive after an affair is discovered different from those that do not?
Well, I would put it maybe slightly differently than how are they different from ones that don't. I would say that there are three primary outcomes that I have studied in couples post-infidelity, where the affair was revealed. And I would go back to people 2, 5, 10 years later and ask them, you know, what has happened to this experience? Do you ever talk about it? How do you feel that it affected you? And also, when you ask the question, you know, we tend to think about an affair as part of a couple. But, you know, if your studies at a university that showed about infidelity, they looked at couples. But if you ask a population, how many of you have been affected by infidelity? You don't get 40%, you get 80 to 90%. Hmm. When it's your parents, when you were the child of, when you are the lover in a triangle, when it's your best friend, the enormity of people who have experienced infidelity as part of their life, even if it's not directly they in the two lead roles, that brings the experience much closer to many of us. I just see my friend with somebody else and I wonder if I should go tell. What do I do with it? So even the question about the disclosure is not just a question about the involved partner revealing it to the person that they are hurting and lying and cheating on. It's also, you know, the entire community. Affairs are systemic. They're not just a dyadic story. Now, there are three main outcomes. You know, one kind of couple will stay together and the affair has become the epicenter of their relationship. Everything comes back to that. There is a chronic resentment. They are stuck. They can't get from out of it. Every time that there is an argument, they come back to what happened. And it is often quite miserable and difficult to know. You know, they're not able to stay and they're not able to leave. And it's about swallowing poison and waiting for the other person to die. That's the degree of resentment that often exists. But then the vast majority of couples are actually what I call the survivors, the people who see this whole thing as a crisis, as a temporary state of insanity, as something that they needed to get out of and then come back to base and reclaim their values of commitment, of continuity, of family life. And they rarely talk about it. The entire thing is underground. They talk about it sometimes with others, but rarely with each other because they don't want to be shaken up. And they are happy that they've been able to come back home and to pursue and continue their life together. And then there is another smaller minority, but a lot of the people, you know, more than 5 million people have watched this TED Talk in less than a year. And what they write to me, thousands of them, is I want to be part of that third group. And that third group is what I call the adventurers or those who are transformed. It's the people for whom the worst day in their life ended up becoming an opportunity. They turn the crisis into new possibilities. They kind of take this line of mine in that talk that somehow has become a source of hope for many people, that most of us anyway are going to leave 2 or 3 marriages at this point in the West with the divorce rate as it is. It's just that some of us are going to do it with the same person. And so they say we want a new marriage with each other. We see what happened. It's not about forgiving necessarily. It's sometimes only about accepting. I'll never forgive what you did. I think it was a terrible thing you did. But I know that it jolted us out of a state of complacency. I know it kind of made us both look at what was going on between us. I want more myself now. Okay, so you did the cheating. I didn't. But now it's my turn to tell you what I want for the to have a different quality in our relationship. And those are the people for whom the affair actually has become a catalyst. And of course, they want to say, did we have to go through this to make things better? And unfortunately, sometimes I have seen that this alarm system is more potent than many others. It because it threatens the entire marriage, the entire family, it really gets people in gear. It gets people listening. And sometimes they've tried to get the other person's attention for a long time. Both of them, by the way. This is not a, one person more than the other. So that those are the three main outcomes that I see in the long haul post-affairs in couples who experience this crisis.
What do you say to someone who says, I am aware that my neighbor, my best friend, my brother-in-law, my sister-in-law is having an affair. Do I tell the other partner? People outside the relationship who are aware.
Oh, yes, of course. It's a conversation. Seriously, if I thought that, you know, anytime somebody asks a question, I always say, I'm not the one who has to live with the consequences of knowing. So I'm not going to risk that with you. Tell me about your friend. Tell me about their partner. What's at stake? What's at stake for the children, if there are any? What's at stake for the finances? What's at stake for them being bullied and shunted out of the entire community? Let's examine this. And then what would it be like for you if you don't say anything? Yesterday, a friend of mine was talking about how by fluke she had the phone of somebody who was an old phone that was given to her, and she had her doubts, so she went to look. And she, it was her closest friend. And she just couldn't live with this idea that her closest friend was going to get married to this man when she knew that the man was acting improperly. And this is before marriage, before commitment. It doesn't have to be the legal marriage per se. But yeah. And so she went to him and she just said, look, I know. She didn't go to many details. I know, and I want you to do something, and I want you to tell her, because otherwise I will need to do so, and I don't want to be the one who does this. And that was the conversation. And he did, and he sat with it, and he realized that this, he was on the wrong track and that he really loved this woman, and he didn't want to be that kind of a guy, even though he had the possibility, etc. It doesn't have to be a man's version of this. It's just the last story I heard. So I sit with people, and I examine what it is like for them to tell or not to tell, what to tell, to whom to tell, and how to tell. And then from there, they make their decision.
Going back to the story that you told earlier, the letter that you had received from a woman who was 41, she hadn't had sex with her husband of 10 years in 7. Is there ever a situation in which you suggest that someone have an affair?
You know, I always think, since adultery has existed, since marriage was invented, and it's the only commandment that is repeated twice in the Bible, nobody needs my advice. The people who are going to do it are going to do it. Right. You know, I do not have nearly that power. I have sat with the couple. If ever this comes up, I will not suggest to people to have affairs ever. I will talk with couples and say, if this marriage, in the case that we are mentioning now, you both care deeply about your relationship. It is an asexual relationship. It is an affectionate, tender, loving, and completely non-sexual relation. Do you want to consider a negotiation of boundaries so that it doesn't have to be done as a lying, as a betrayal, as a cheating, but it is done as part of a new arrangement between the two of you? Or are you so wedded to a certain romantic ideal that you are not achieving, in which you end up living in shame, and in which you are going to resent each other for having lost such an important part of who you are, both of you for that matter? I don't consider that this is just her problem. And then the only option you have is either to stay in this desert or to divorce. Can we understand that there isn't one size fits all when it comes to marriage, and that maybe at least this conversation, many people will rather do the divorce, dismantle the entire system, loosen up and lose all the ties that they had, than broach that much more difficult conversation, which is that maybe there isn't one person for everything, not between the two of us. And then they say it's too painful. I say, and in the case of this couple, it's the man who is not approaching his partner and he's rejecting her for all these years or refusing her or feeling a block or whatever. But there are also cases where it's even more painful when this very man is then found out having an affair. Hmm. After he refused his partner, male or female partner for that matter, for all those years, then it's a double whammy, right? Not only did you reject and abandon me, but then I find out that you've been going elsewhere when I gave up my entire sexuality, my entire femininity, my entire masculinity, whichever, for, you know, in order to be committed to you. So these things are intense. They are painful. They are not simple. They can't be just codified like that. I would bring the two of them in and I would say, what kind of relationship do you want to have? And do you want, because as is, you are a ticking time bomb for infidelity, because you feel dead, you feel numb, you feel rejected, you feel like you haven't been touched like an adult, not just like a family member, but like a sexualized being for years. And then one day somebody walks past you in your life and your hair stands up on your skin and you remember and you say, oh boy, I haven't felt this in decades. And from that place, the affair starts. It's not just some simple fling. And that's the longing we're talking about. You know, that's why people talk about aliveness. And I'm saying to these people, you are waiting for infidelity around the corner. This isn't right. Why are you setting yourself up for such kind of a crisis? You can avoid this crisis. It's going to require a very different kind of conversation. Of course, we're working also, you know, to rekindle the sexuality between them. And I'm launching a course right now on rekindling desire online. But I don't necessarily think that it will work for every couple. So you go on, as a therapist, I work on every front. I will try to have this couple reconnect sexually, erotically, intimately with each other. But I also understand that there's some very powerful blocks that are at stake when you have a 10-year asexual relationship or 7 years. That's not a high number for that matter. And I want the couple to be able to consider different ways of staying together so that it isn't an all or nothing with just a sense of despair that creeps up inside of each person.
Esther Perel is a relationship therapist and TED speaker. She will be in town tomorrow to conduct a workshop called The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity at SMU Plano. Esther, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks.